Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation, where we're continuing to take a look at great debates. Our guest in this half hour is Christopher Phillips. Christopher Phillips has a passion for inquiry. He is a specialist in the Socratic method and reminds us that we ought to ask questions, not about any chance question, as Socrates put it, but about the way one should live. Phillips believes that the process of dialogue and the space of human interaction are good for us as individuals and essential for us as a society. Chris Phillips has been traveling the world orchestrating these discussions at nursing homes, maximum security prisons, churches, homeless shelters, bookstores, and coffee houses. And adding to that is now Harwood Union High School, where he's going to be coming on Monday to give one of what he calls a democracy cafe to the residents in this area. Christopher Phillips, welcome to the Vermont Conversation. Well, it looks like we just dropped his call there, so we're going to try and get him back. And as we wait for him, just a little bit more about what it is that he does. These Socrates cafes and Constitution cafes have been the subject of four different books that he has written. They have been the rage and the subject of different debates for some years, and they're still going strong at various places around the country. I think I've read that he has been doing some 2,000 of these in recent years. And he's taken this show on the road around the country as well as around the world. Some of the topics that he has dealt with include, his new book is a bit of a departure from what he used to do. It's called The Philosophy of Childing, Reimagining Adulthood Through the Wisdom of Our Youngest. And this is we'll hopefully get to hear him riff a bit on this topic. Dr. Phillips earned his PhD in communications, and he has a master's degree in humanities, the natural sciences, and in education. We're going to take a short break while we get Christopher Phillips back on the line, and we'll come back to you in just a moment.
My name is Susan Steven. I met Candace at a running clinic Central Vermont Medical Center Rehab Department had this fall.
I was very much overweight, diabetic. I could run like literally for 10 seconds. When I first started with the Alter-G, it was amazing. It lifted me off of my feet. And, you know, I started to walk.
Alter-G treadmill reduces the effect of gravity on the lower body.
I wasn't gimping, no pain. And if something is uncomfortable, you just support yourself a little bit more so you can keep working out, building up some of that endurance. I'm still panicked about running a marathon, but I know that I can move. I've lost 41 pounds. You know, I've made this promise, and I can't not try.
So if you're training or you have pain when you walk, we'll put you on the Alter-G and let you try it out.
The University of Vermont Health Network, Central Vermont Medical Center, central to your well-being.
Well, we're back here. We have Christopher Phillips on the line. Christopher Phillips, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Well, thank you.
So what led you to decide to lead dialogues all over the world?
It was in part out of a sense that there were no longer public places and spaces in which people of really diverse ways of seeing things felt comfortable coming together and exploring ideas with one another and actually celebrating the fact that they didn't see eye to eye. I don't think a democracy, a participatory sort, can thrive if we feel like we can only have a reasonable discussion with somebody that we already know sort of more or less agrees with us. It's not to say at all that we have to embrace all points of view. I find some points of view actually quite heinous and abhorrent. But sometimes even those with whom I see eye to eye, we come to the same conclusions maybe for very different reasons. But we can only know that by giving serious and equal consideration to a wide variety of perspectives. And so way back in 1996, when the second term of the Clinton administration, when he was undergoing impeachment proceedings and Americans were woefully polarized, I decided to sort of put this experiment to the test. And I began holding dialogues that I called Socrates Cafe with people hither and yon, sort of using what I would call a modern-day agora, where people could exchange ideas and ideals using a sort of a version of the Socratic method that I've been developing. And it worked. It's sort of, even after all these years, it still has a momentum. And many groups have been ongoing for quite a long time, and some new groups are still forming.
Remind us who Socrates was.
Well, I argue in my first book, Socrates Cafe, there's not absolutely definitive proof that he still existed, though I think there's enough triangulating evidence. You know, he was a philosopher in the 5th century B.C. And you know, he was an adult and at a time when the Athenian polis no longer was keen on having the kinds of exchanges in the open forum that for him made life most worth living. So it was no one really knew it at the time, but it was actually in a period not just of stasis but of irreversible decline by the time he began his inquiries and dialogues. He felt, even when he was convicted for impiety and for corrupting the youth of Athens by the new oligarchy that came in place and supplanted the democratic regime, that if he was given a choice of either being put to death or being sent into exile, he felt that it would be a death of a different sort and far worse. So he was in prison and he drank hemlock and died rather than having to curtail the questioning life. And so that example is kind of spoken to a lot of people across the ages and across many different types of cultures and belief systems. Folks who believe that if we are going to have open societies and not just pay lip service, then we have to be willing to ask hard questions and be willing to interrogate them very rigorously with people from lots of different points of views of societies to have a prayer of a chance of advancing on local or global scales.
So does the end that Socrates met, being put to death or perhaps putting himself to death, as it were, what's it make you think about, you know, what if people don't want to talk? What if this is not something that they are, in fact, seeking out, dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, you can't make people do what they don't want to do, can you? And I know that a lot of people just are no longer inured to going to a public place to have an inquiry. And I can't say I blame them. I mean, look at so many things that are billed as inquiry or exchange on TV and radio these days. And really, the people who engage one another just think it's more of a one-upmanship, browbeating, interrupting. He who talks the loudest and interrupts and humiliates the other person the most wins, whatever that can possibly mean. So if that's the example that most people see, then I would dare say they would be quite hesitant to attempt it themselves. Even my best friends, when I broached this idea to them in 96, thought I was a little bit wacky. But I think people can sort of rise to their higher angels if you set an example of a careful and thoughtful listener. Yeah, I'm never there to play stump the participant. I certainly have no agenda to proselytize them to any particular point of view. But rather to sort of create a setting where, and to model thoughtful inquiry and careful listening. And I have found in the many thousands of dialogues I've held, not just in the U.S., but all over the world, that far, far more often than not, people get more than rise to the occasion themselves when they see what it's all about, and they leave exhilarated and enthused and wanting more. And so these are the groups I start are grassroots oriented. I'm not, you know, Socrates on the spot or anything like that. It's all about them feeling like this is something that is of worth in their community, and that it helps create the types of bonds among members of the community that manage to achieve sort of a dual goal of making people both more socially conscious, but also creating a greater sense of autonomy in their ways of thinking. There's this misconception that somehow group inquiry has to lead to groupthink. And it certainly can, but if there's a certain method of inquiry employed, it can actually lead to greater autonomy in thinking, but at the same time in a way that builds connections among people. My experience is that those aren't at opposite ends of continuum, but can readily go hand in glove.
So I'm curious how you would raise, deal with a hot button issue of the day in a way that yields a different outcome than, you know, the shouting matches we see on TV. Let's take, for example, the issue of abortion.
Yes.
Very emotional, very hot, very hard to get people off of the positions that they come into the room with. How do you approach it?
Yes, and I think one of the problems is we start talking about hot button issues before we even know whether we have anything in common. I mean, why? And I think it can sort of be a self-defeating proposition if we just start having at it about whether abortion is right or wrong. And the same applies whether we're talking about hot button topics about same-sex marriage, whether we should be in war in Afghanistan or Iraq. I think we have to take a few steps back and wait to talk about sort of these yes or no questions and what we think about them and why, and sort of engage in a hammer and tongs type debate, and first ask ourselves maybe a question is, who has the right to life? You know? I mean, because suddenly what that does is it's not skirting the issue, but what it is it's forcing and inspiring people to posit in a very thoughtful and thorough way their philosophical perspective on the subject. And by doing that, and by having everybody do that who's engaged in the inquiry, and by looking at what speaks for and against a variety of point of views, by looking at whether some views are more tenable than others, people kind of discover on their own that, wow, they might actually differ on what their answer is in terms of is abortion right or wrong, but they nonetheless might have some remarkably similar notions on what the right to life amounts to and who might have that right to life. You never will know that if you just start engaging immediately on the hot button issue question, on right to life as in contemporary society. So what I do, try to do again and again, is think up a question or get the group to think up a question, which we sort of come at it from a more foundational philosophical perspective. If it's about the death penalty, we might ask a question like, who owns human life? If it's about same-sex marriage, or if we want a question that touches upon that, we might simply ask, what is an excellent marriage? If it's about whether we should go to war or in Iraq or Afghanistan, we might ask, what is a just war? Because then again, while people may differ radically over which wars are just and which are not, they may nonetheless have remarkably similar notions of what constitutes a just war. But we don't know that if we don't ask the right types of questions and frame them in ways that launch a thoughtful, it can still be very impassioned, but in a way that leads to the development of lots of points of views where it's more about really exploring a variety of perspectives than this kind of knockdown, drag out debate where it's all about argument and counter-argument and somebody's trying to win something.
We're talking with Christopher Phillips here on the Vermont Conversation. He is holding a Socratic dialogue that he calls a Socrates Cafe or a Democracy Cafe. I guess it goes by different titles. You can join this conversation by calling 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. The talks that you give do go by these different names. Is there a difference between a Democracy Cafe and a Socrates Cafe?
Yes, there are. If people want to go to our nonprofit website at democracycafe.org, there are a variety of dialogue initiatives that we have, everything from the longtime Socrates Cafe to a more recent initiative called Constitution Cafe, which was the subject of the last book I had written with the subtitle Jefferson's Brew for a True Revolution, in which we look at what we would, which again I gather with motley people to examine what we would like our Constitution to say if we had our druthers, and if we could rewrite it. And I also hold First Amendment conversations with cops, at a time when, you know, so many law enforcement give their oath to preserve and protect and uphold the Constitution, but many actually haven't read it. So it's very important to have thoughtful discourse with law enforcement officers, especially in First Amendment issues. And the Democracy Cafe, which is the name of our nonprofit group, but it's also the name of a dialogue initiative in which the sort of philosophical questions that we pose deal more specifically with themes that treat with open societies and what we think open societies should be all about.
Can you describe a cafe that you've held where you saw something remarkable happen? You know, perhaps you saw people leave the experience with a different point of view than the one they entered with.
I think what happens pretty often is that it's not so much a specific experience, but when somebody has a particular perspective and then she listens to somebody else and then says, you know, I was thinking X, but now you have me thinking that maybe I'm not as right as I thought I was, or that maybe I need to reconsider my notion based on what you've said. I mean, the mere fact that they think that this is a safe enough place to admit something like that is rather remarkable at a time when people, I don't know about you, but if somebody tries to change my opinion overtly, the last thing I'm going to do is change it merely because they're trying. But so to create an ambiance where people feel that comfortable enough to do that is quite remarkable. I was at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, a few weeks ago, and we were having this sort of open-ended dialogue on the question, what is best value? And, you know, people taking part were military officers and folks involved in defense acquisitions for both the public sector and the private sector. And you might think that they might see things quite eye to eye, and I think they were surprised just at how differently they thought of what is best value, whether it's making a purchase for something for their home, or whether engaged in a transaction and selling a piece of military hardware, and how their own personal views can quite often differ with those of their superiors or with their customers. And it was quite an unsettling experience for those there who had known each other for a very long time to realize that they had remarkably different perspectives. At the same time, I think it was exhilarating for them. And so at first, I think they were hesitant to reveal just how different they saw things. But once they really got into it, it was just a very moving and memorable thing when they started saying, gosh, you know, I had thought that my way was the right way, but now you really have me looking at things from quite a different angle. It's just nice that it is still possible in this day and age for people to feel comfortable enough to say such things out loud.
Lately, you've been writing about a very different topic, parenthood. One of the pieces you've written this fall in the Huffington Post was about fatherhood's unexpected life lessons. Tell us a little bit about what those, what some unexpected life lessons are that you've learned.
Oh, I have a book coming out next year called The Philosophy of Childing. And again, it's a Socratic take. I would argue that this notion that we have called parenting, that at least the definition is skewed. We define parenting as the raising of a child, when I would say that it's the raising of a parent. And so I came up with this notion of childing, which is actually used quite a bit by Shakespeare, where we all need one another equally, but in different ways, people of very, very different ages, if we're going to continue flourishing in every age and stage. I became a dad late in life. I became a dad for the first time at 47, and then again at the ripe old age of 54. I've got a 20-month-old running around somewhere in this house right now, so to speak. And so the life lessons I've learned are one of the involved a great doses of humility, where I have taken a very non-hierarchical approach. After many stumbling failures, trying to take a more traditional approach as a parent. And not in any way sort of they're saying that the role of a parent isn't important, but just looking at it very differently than the way that I was raised as a child, and sort of looking at many of the hypocrisies when I sort of seek to correct my child when I think she's teasing somebody else, or when she's, you know, behaving in a way that I find inappropriate, and then realize that in my own adult fashion I've been doing darn well the same thing, but haven't been applying the same things to myself. And so the sort of philosophy of childing is based on the fact that kids, in their way, can be just as, if not more, empathetic, that maybe they reason in extremely different ways than adults, but they nonetheless reason quite well, that they see things more holistically than we adults, who have been far too taken in by Aristotle and love to just break things down into, you know, category after category and look at things more microscopically. And so I benefit immensely in ways that I never imagined when I finally decided to take the leap and become a parent, and sort of was able finally to answer for myself, why in the world would I bring a child in the world when they're given all the uncertainty that exists? And what and so, but it didn't really dawn on me. I've heard other parents say it, you know, how much you learn and grow and all those things. But I still think that our philosophies of raising children, even among people I consider quite progressive, still are skewed towards being, you know, sort of looking down at children as a little bit lesser than we are. And that we, of course, we do have to be there to make sure that they don't touch a hot stove, or and to tie their shoelaces maybe when they're young, to keep them safe, but so they can in turn become explorers and learners in ways that we can join in on the adventure and learn along with them.
So you recount that your daughter Callie, which is short for Calliope.
Calliope, that's a Greek name.
And she asked you a question that stumped you, which was, she asked, was becoming a daddy always one of your goals? Yes. And the truth is, it wasn't.
No, in fact, I was quite happy as a childless daddy. A childless daddy, when was that? That's an oxymoron. A childless couple. And I was hesitant to become a dad for a variety of reasons. But my wife wanted to be a mommy, and this is the love of my life, and who was I to say no? And so I overcame a lot of hesitancy and doubt, and did. I didn't. I told my daughter Callie that it wasn't until well after she was born that I realized, after all, that this was something that I truly wanted to do, and that this was a role that I wanted to have. I don't think I was being disingenuous with her, but I think that it was only by sort of taking that leap of faith and becoming a parent that, and overcoming a lot of not just doubts, but just the fact that I was perfectly happy as a childless hubby. But then sort of taking part in that grand adventure of becoming a parent and raising a child and realizing, if anything, she was raising me even more. And what an extraordinary experience it has been. It has certainly redoubled my convictions to do what I can in my very, very modest way, you know, to make the world more livable and lovable, not just for my daughter, but for, you know, children all over the planet. I mean, you've got so many people caught in the crosshairs of conflicts that are not of their creation. So many people are injured, maimed, killed every day from tragic conflicts that are not of their making. Many of these the result of U.S. policy. And if we don't sort of do what we can, if we don't each do our bit to stand up and be counted, I mean, yes, we all have to put on blinders in some ways, but we, I mean, why do we bring in new generations if we're just going to carry them from one adult-created conflict after another? I mean, nothing makes me more livid than when adults start calling, you know, like this great book that sold great guns called Consumed, and everybody said that we were just acting like children. The fact is, we're acting like irresponsible adults, and we shouldn't lay these pernicious labels on kids. We should call things for what they are and realize that maybe, just maybe, if we allowed children to take a much more prominent role in the decision-making processes, maybe the world would be much more peaceful than it is now.
So you're going to be coming to Vermont, to Harwood Union High School, on Monday. Tell us a little bit about what can people expect when they go to this Socrates Cafe that you'll be conducting.
They can expect to go on a bit of an adventure in which maybe they'll be open and exposed to perspectives and horizons that they otherwise wouldn't be privy to. What they might find the most surprising is that maybe as they take part in the dialogue and offer up their own ideas, that they'll discover they harbored perspectives that they didn't even realize that they had. I think one of the reasons why, after all these years, that I still enjoy doing this so much is, in many respects, for sort of selfish reasons, because I get so much out of it and I learn a lot more about myself. I find that, you know, when I'm by myself, kind of left to my own devices, I might have a certain notion of what I think. But it's only when I really engage with thoughtful others in this kind of discursive method, where we not just say what we think, but why we think what we think,
okay,
and really,
yep,
sympathetically immerse ourselves in others' thinking, that we might realize that a lot of notions we have are starkly different than what we thought.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Christopher Phillips, thanks so much for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation. And for people who want to attend your Democracy Cafe, it'll be at Harwood Union High School, 6 o'clock on Monday evening. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 with another
conversation. You have been listening to Vermont Conversation. David Goodman, made possible by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and its 750-plus members. Additional support is provided by National Life Insurance, for over 150 years working for a better tomorrow. By Fairpoint Communications, small businesses make it big with Fairpoint. By the Alchemist Brewery, serving Greater Waterbury and Vermont since 2003. And Let's Grow Kids, focusing on the first years of child development. By the University of Vermont Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. And Green Mountain Power, partnering with customers to provide clean, reliable, and cost-effective power. Join us again next Wednesday at 1 o'clock for David Goodman's Vermont Conversations.
Was asked about any worries he may have about Iran's involvement with Shiite militias currently fighting the Sunni-based militant group.
We are all concerned about what happens after the drums stop beating and ISIL is defeated, and whether the government of Iraq will remain on a path to provide an inclusive government for all of the various groups.
Secretary of State John Kerry, Defense Secretary Ash Carter also testified, Kerry criticizing Senate Republicans for sending a letter to Iran about the current nuclear talks. He told the senators that Congress cannot change anything if an agreement is reached.
They don't have the right to modify an agreement reached executive to executive between leaders of a country.
Committee member Kentucky Senator Rand Paul tells Kerry that he backed the letter because of how the White House has been trying to circumvent Congress.
I signed this letter because I signed it to an administration that doesn't listen.